And since the bells are such a kind of simple and straightforward topic, I have 13 pages of notes. Because that's the way I roll. All right. So the bells are kind of an integral part of our experience in the Zendo. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the kind of the mechanics of working with and interacting with the bells. And I'm going to talk about kind of some larger dharmic perspectives on them and the practices of listening and hearing that are associated with the bells. And also, as you'll see in some of the quotes that I'm going to read, bells often have a kind of life and death quality associated with them. They're significant throughout kind of literature. So when we deal with the bells in Zen, often when the instrumentalists take their position, they'll bow to the instruments, acknowledging them as teachers, as partners, as members of the Sangha, even. I was reminded today of an old line from The Honeymooners, that old TV sitcom in which the guy, whatever his name is learning to play golf, and somebody says that the first thing to do is to address the ball. And he goes, "Hello, ball." So we could begin with "Hello, bell." I want to first of all encourage all of you to not think of striking the bell or hitting the bell, but of inviting it to sound or sounding the bell. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about wakening the bell. And that's there's the kind of gentle quality with which we call forth its presence, call forth the sound. And you know, one of the things that's interesting about, you know, the way we use the small timekeeper's bell to signal the beginning of the period, we do three strikes, and between each strikes we wait for it to go almost to the point of inaudibility, maybe 90% gone. And so I'm going to just demonstrate this for a moment. What happened in your mind with the first strike of the bell? One of the things that's interesting is we kind of create for ourselves a kind of almost Pavlovian response of zazen, of kind of collecting the energy, you know, because we begin each period with this, and so it kind of pulls us in. And these bells should be very inviting, very welcoming, very kind of gradual. In the Zen arts, both the aesthetic arts and the martial arts, all of the movement, all of the kind of the center of your being is called the hara, which is around three fingers below the navel, and that's where we kind of not in our way of talking about it, but many teachings of Zen emphasize that we sit zazen from there, and you bring your attention into the hara. And you know, so normally we kind of tend to locate ourselves kind of in the center of our head. And one thing to experiment with is kind of imagining taking that kind of sense of self and pulling it physically down into the hara and sitting your zazen from there. And then you'll notice that as soon as your mind moves, it pops back up. And then you can bring it back down. And that's the place where we ring the bells from. And we let our hands and be an expression of our breath. So they're breathing out as we strike the bell. And then striking, inviting it to sound from the hara. And you know, so we have that kind of associative quality with these bells, and that kind of gives them a really rich utility elsewhere in our lives. They can kind of sanctify a moment, and we can use them to signify the beginning of any kind of work practice, whether it's like formal work practice at a retreat, or whether it's just doing the dishes. Ringing the bell at the beginning of that practice, you know, both for, you know, its kind of own natural reasons and because of our associative reasons, kind of brings us into the meditative quality of just washing the dishes, of washing the dishes as practice. There's a
couple of koans that have to do with bells that I'm going to read. And then there's a few poems, one of which, I'll get to later, the Chandan poem, which in my research I identified as universally misquoted. Little teaser for you. This is case 16 of the Gateless Gate, the Mulankan. The sound of the bell and the seven-panel robe. Unman said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do we put on our seven-panel robe at the sound of the bell?" The seven-panel robe is, of course, the kesa or the raksu, and then Muman's commentary on this. Master Muman is, of course, the compiler of the great Gateful Gate, or the Grateful Gate, which is kind of cool too. A fraction of Muan's commentary says, "When you hear a sound, just tell me, does the sound come to the ear or the ear go to the sound? Even though you have extinguished both sound and silence, what will you realize here? If you hear with the ear, you cannot realize it. When you hear with the eye for the first time, it will become intimate." My first teacher, Daido, would often talk about hearing sounds with the whole body and mind, seeing forms with the whole body and mind. Master Unman gives us a kind of particularly synesthetic approach to hear with the eye. So, when you hear a sound, does the sound come to the ear or the ear go to the sound? And this reminds me of the lines from Master Dogen Shogo Genzo. "To carry the self forward and realize the 10,000 dharmas is delusion. That the 10,000 dharmas advance and realize the self is enlightenment." So the practice, the Zen practice of hearing, is to let the sound come to you. Not to send the mind out afterward, grabbing and naming and identifying, but just to let the sound come and wash all over you, hearing it with all the pores on your body, hearing it even with the eye, letting it resonate throughout the entire body mind. That's the practice of hearing. And this is also the way we practice with and this relationship to the bell and this relationship to hearing, we also can practice with all of the other non-bell sounds of the world. We can hear those as mindfulness bells, as kind of resonant expressions of the perfection of things as they are. And this is what we do when there are you know, children downstairs here in the church where we practice, or there's the choir rehearsing or something like that. We let those sounds come into our practice. Rather than pushing them away, we let them come in and we hear them with the whole body and mind. We hear them with the entirety of our breath, with the entirety of our zazen. And what happens when we send our mind after that, what is that? What is that sound? Man, that is so annoying. I really just wish they would shut up because I'm trying to do zazen here. That's the mind going outward and realizing the 10,000 things, and that's what Dogen calls the delusion. But just receiving those, letting the sounds fall in, letting the reactions in your mind that come in response to those sounds arise, and just receiving that with the whole body and mind. And hearing the bell, both hearing the bell and ringing the bell, can be a practice of non-judgment and just receiving. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the way the bells get rung, but I don't want to kind of engender in you, whether you're ringing the bell or hearing the bell, a sense of right and wrong, and a sense of constantly assessing, how's that bell sound? How's he ringing it? What's going on there? And so it's a practice to really receive the perfection in all its myriad expressions. And so this is something that we see on retreat, that is expressly used on retreat, right? So when we go to retreat and we do sesshin, when we're going to interviews with the teacher, there's a bell at each kind of doksan line. And before we go in, we ring the bell twice. And with that sound, we are communicating inexorably and directly where our mind is. We're communicating the entire state of our practice, sending our mind ahead to the teacher and out to the Sangha. And you hear this all. You can hear when there's somebody who's clearly having a very difficult day at sesshin. You can hear when they're at the bell. And then sometimes you hear, you can just kind of feel a sense of peace radiating from the bell. But just as a still mind isn't good zazen and a busy mind isn't bad zazen, neither of those bell sounds is bad. Neither of them is problematic. They're just the thusness of the way they are. So this bell, the case, it's called, which is spelled K-E-S-U. U's are sometimes silent in Japanese. This bell is the one that invites us into service. And so the three bells that begin the service come a little bit more closely together, because each one is kind of raising the energy and kind of preparing us spill out even more energy in the form of our chanting. And so those come together. So let me just talk a little bit about the form. So you can ring the bell, ringing the bell from the hara. You can hold your hand that is not holding the striker. You can either hold it in gassho or you can hold it in zazen position. But it's important to use one of those positions, because this is really it kind of brings our attention into the zazen of bell ringing. And you can there's various ways to move your hand. Some ring in a kind of circular fashion, or you can just go directly at the outside corner, or you can ring it from the inside. And all of those thank you very much. Experiment with each of those. And just as with zazen, there's a practice of aiming at a clean, pure sound, yet not getting caught up in the mechanics of good and bad. So there's a we're aiming at a sound that's kind of pure resonance without the kind of knock or clack of striker against bowl. There's a story of I forget who it was. I think it's some 20th century Zen teacher who was practicing Zen archery, and he stood on the top of a cliff and shot the arrow off into the distance, and it was a foggy day, so he couldn't even see where it goes. So he shot it, he let it go, and he said, "Bullseye!" That's the spirit with which we ring the bell. Every shot is a bullseye. When I was at Zen Mountain Monastery, there's a person who came to teach Kyudo, which is which is Zen archery, and this guy was the 22nd in the lineage of the imperial bow maker to the emperor of Japan. This is the guy who the very definition of Zen archery, and he was really kind of a intensely present dude. He was kind of old; he was 70, and I remember he did a demonstration. And they set up the target, came up, he did it, and there's a ritual kind of exposing the shoulder for some reason, and then the posture, and then the release. And I remember being really struck by the fact that he missed the target completely. But who am I? That's clearly what Zen archery is, and that's the spirit of bell ringing too. So these three bells at the beginning of service come roughly at this pace. And then there's another thing we do with the bell, which is called a gatz, which is G-A-T-Z-U. Again, the silent Z U. And this is a sound. It isn't just a cessation of the ringing. It's a different sound we use the bell to make. And we stop it with the striker and the hand. And then that indicates, the service. We feel how that indicates something's happening right now. And ideally, if the service is kind of functioning at peak efficiency, there aren't places between chants or something where it falls to total silence, and the bell is what kind of fills in and holds together that thing. So returning to the sound of the bell and the seven-panel robe. So part of what this poem is about is, why are we practicing? Why are we even here? Why do we, and especially in the context of a monastery, why do we get up at 3:30 in the morning and put on our robes and go and sit? And why, when we hear the bell at the beginning of our Zazen period, why do we go through the trouble of sitting still? Why do we do that thing? And this is what this koan and the Mumon Fan is inviting us to take up. I just want to read you Mumon's verse. With realization, all things are one family. Without realization, everything is separate and different. Without realization, all things are one family. With realization, everything is separate and different. This is Mumon doing what he does best, which is cutting off all avenues of escape. I always feel like he's kind of messing with us. But it's wonderful messing with. And there's such a playful, non-attached quality to Master Mumon. And now Koan Yamada, who is one of our ancestral teachers, comments on this case. He's saying, every morning in a monastery, when the appointed time comes, the bell is rung. Upon hearing it, the monks put on their seven-panel kesa and go to the hall to participate in the morning ceremony. But why? Ah, this why. It is the wonderful charm, the magical talisman, which brings a Zen student to enlightenment. This why is the miraculous means of putting away the why of reasoning, with all its thoughts and ideas, and to pursue the why, you must surpass the why. And related to the why, I've quoted before Ezra Beda, who says that why is not itself a spiritual question. It's a kind of philosophical question. It's a tool of inquiry. The real spiritual question in Zen is what? What is this? What is here right now? When we hear the bell, what is here right now? When we put on a 7-panel robe, what is here right now? Another teacher, Bhante Gunaratna in the Theravadan tradition, suggests kind of setting like a timer on your computer to kind of ring a bell sound like once an hour, and then when you hear that, to do a minute of zazen or mindfulness practice, and then to kind of peel yourself away from what you're doing and just really be present. And there's so to let the bell call us to practice in that way. So also related to this practice of hearing, to this practice of receiving sounds, is the Shin Pure Land practice of hearing. And in Shin, they're very clear that the practice is hearing, not listening. It emphasizes the receptive quality, and Namu Amida Butsu, the name of Amida Buddha, is called the name that calls. It calls you forth. It calls you into the Pure Land. It calls you to presence, to just as it is. So the other koan in which we encounter a bell is in the first of the miscellaneous koans, which we do after checking questions following mu and the sound of the single hand. And that koan is, stop the sound of the distant temple bell. Stop the sound of the distant temple bell. And in a book called The Flowing Bridge, Sister Elaine McInnes, who is one of Robert Aitken's Dharma Sisters, another heir of Yamada Roshi, who I just read to us from, is talking about this poem, and she's talking about the sound of the bell in the monastery. It's a long sound, very resonant. The reverberations go on and are carried into infinity. The temple bell is very sacred. It is never rung quickly. The sound is usually not repeated until the vibrations of the first are completed and gone to their rest. It is an introverted sound and will descend to the very depths of your being. Now, are you comfortable with that bell? First you have to ring it, and then you've got to stop it. Ridiculous, isn't it? And what truth could it possibly be pointing at? And then just a little sidestep into the koan here. Elaine McInnes goes on to say, the stopping of the bell is a kind of hook of the koan. Don't bite on it and get caught. Our experience of life shows us usually only the phenomenal world, which separates us from bells. In our Zen practice, we must become prophets, those who see and proclaim things as they are. But you will not see as a prophet until you cut down the separations, until you close the gap between you and mu. You will never discover what mu is. You will never know God, human beings, or creation until your knowing becomes experience. Touching on the life or death quality, the life and death quality of bells, there's a poem actually by our eponymous Ralph Waldo Emerson, and it's called, in fact, The Bell. I love thy music, mellow bell. I love thine iron chime, to life or death, to heaven or hell, which calls the sons of time. Thy voice upon the deep, the homebound sea boy hails. It charms his cares to sleep, it cheers him as he sails. To house of God and heavenly joys, thy summons called our signs, and good men thought thy sacred voice disarmed the thunder's fires. And soon thy music, sad death bell, shall lift its notes once more, and mix my requiem with the wind that sweeps my native shore. I also want to read to you. I'm not going to do a lot of reading. I'm just going to spare you from my own commentary. I want to read to you this this piece by Lynn Jensen about bell ringing. And Lynn Jensen, this is from a book called Pavement, Essays on Mercy, Activism, and Doing Nothing for Peace. And you know, Lynn is very good at kind of just drawing out the kind of small specificity of practice, the kind of each momentness of it. In the Soto Zen tradition in which I first trained, three strikes of the gong signal the start of meditation and one strike the end. My training in this took place during a crowded retreat at a Soto monastery where I'd been asked to help out by timing the afternoon period of Zazen. Monk Chushin set me to practicing the gong. He demonstrated first, and my recollection is that the gong rang out sweetly without even a hint of the percussion of the striker against its rim. "Don't just hit it," Chushin said. "Invite the gong to sound." I wasn't at all sure how one invites the gong to sound. And when I tried to do so, the resulting clatter was more like I'd whacked at a piece of sheet metal with a serving spoon than anything remotely like the sound Monk Chushin had gotten. I knew that in less than an hour I'd have to strike it, not once as I just had, but three times in a row, and not in the forgiving absence of anyone within hearing, but a meditation hall full of 40 other people. I tapped anxiously at the gong surface, experimenting with different angles and velocities and placements of striking. Nothing really worked, but somehow, in a sweat of all this failure, I took notice of the striker. It occurred to me then that this wasn't a situation strictly between the gong and me. The striker had a stake in the outcome as well. And I also realized that while I was thinking of the striker as an instrument for my use, I could just as well think of myself as an instrument for the striker's use. After all, it was the striker and not my hand that connected with the gong. And since I wasn't doing so well, why not let the striker invite the gong to sound? Later, when I rang the start of meditation, the striker and gong managed just fine without me. Our practice is to receive this world as it is, without imposing conditions on entry. It holds the gift of our life, the one of our frustration and ambitions never dreamt of. When I take up the striker and ring the gong now, I hope to do so as if I'd never rung a gong before and never would again. When I can quiet myself enough to truly look and listen, a music as sweet as a singing sky settles over me, and a free, fresh world is run in anew with each succeeding breath. So, in the John Donne poem, which is called, interestingly, Meditation 17, speaking of the bell, the line that we all would probably quote from memory is, ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. That's not actually the line that John Byrne says. This is also the life and death spirit of the bell. Who cast, and brace yourself for some archaic language. Who casts not his eye to the sun when it rises? Who takes off his eye from a comet when that breaks out? Who bends not his ear to any bell which upon any occasion rings? But who can remove it from that bell which is passing a piece of himself out of this world? Which is exactly what we're doing when we're going into Doksan, passing a piece of ourselves out into the world. And then John Donne goes on to point to the reality of interdependence. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor or thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know, for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Obviously, somebody translated it into modern English for our consumption there. In the Kwannon school of Korean Zen, as it's manifested in America, it actually doesn't have the Kwannon school doesn't actually have an analog in Korea. They do what's called a morning bell chant. Which has this line. These lines: may the sound of this bell spread throughout the universe, relieve the three realms of suffering, shatter the hells, and bring all beings to enlightenment. And sometimes that'll happen, and you know, just that's going to be the sound that comes out. And there's a way to compassionately receive ourselves and that sound. Everything we do is kind of a complete expression of our Zen and of ourselves. There's nowhere to hide.
Actually,
Sure. Right. And especially in Soto Zen, in the kind of the traditional Soto Zen, of which Boundless Way is not at all a kind of member, you know. So we kind of use koans as a teaching tool. And we teach Shikantaza, but Soto Zen traditionally, the main form of teaching is the forms itself, is the way that the posture is held, is the way that the bowls are laid out, that the bell is struck. Each of these things are an expression of faith mind, of the of their trust in the perfection of things that they are. And of the in original Buddha nature, and each of those things. And so the Soto school really, really minutely scrutinizes those things. And to see them do it, it's beautiful and balletic and just completely lovely. And when our Dharma brother Edward was at Soto camp this summer, you know, he told the story of that you know, in Boundless Way we don't really emphasize the form so much. And one of the other Soto Zen teachers there said, well, then how do the teachers know what the students are practicing? So that is the means of communication, and instruction around those things is one of the means in which the Dharma is transmitted. And the sound of the bell and is the expression of the practice rather than what goes on in Doksan. We use Doksan as one of our main tools, whether you're working on koans or not, and that is not a traditional Soto style. And instead, Soto does exactly that. Thank you guys for coming out on this lovely spring evening when there's clearly so much of excellence to be done.